Welcome to Media Path. I'm Fritz Pullman.
And I'm Louise Palanker.
You know, we're more than a podcast. We are a cultural touchstone, a dictator of taste, a driver of conversation. Okay. But most of all, we bring you very talented guests. I am so excited to have Kevin Pollak on with us today. For my money, one of the world's great impressionists, a successful comedian, an actor and writer and director. You remember him from The Usual Suspects, A Few Good Men, and credits too many to list, and we'll talk about more about that later. All kinds of film credits and TV credits, including The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, a wonderful show that ran five seasons. Right now, he's doing a podcast called Mrs. Maisel Rewatch, and we're going to talk to Kevin about that, and he'll be along very shortly. It's pretty fun.
I think the full title is My Mrs. Maisel, and then : A Rewatch Podcast.
Wow, you're like spell check. That was very well done.
You're welcome.
Okay. We're going to have a good time. Anyway, Wheezy, what do you have for us?
Oh, yes. So I've been watching the TV, and I've been watching Girls on the Bus. It is loosely based on a book by Amy Chozick called Chasing Hillary. The book is a memoir of Amy's almost 10-year journey chronicling for the New York Times Hillary's attempt to become her first female president. Along that path, Amy gets married, she strives towards the upper echelons of political journalism, and considers freezing her eggs until after the 2016 campaign. Thus are the confounding challenges of any woman who seeks a career and a family, as did Hillary. Although inspired by the book, the series is pure fiction. The candidates, their staffs, the girls on the bus, all fictional. The issues and themes, however, remain consistent. How much of ourselves do we pour into others and their dreams in pursuit of ours? The girls on the campaign bus for the fictional female candidate based on, but not Hillary, are Sadie, whose gonzo style at a legacy outlet is inspired by Hunter Thompson; Grace, a battle-tested veteran of the political circus who has prioritized breaking scoops over her husband and her troubled college-age daughter; Kimberlyn, a rising star with a Fox-type network. Recently engaged, she is juggling the workload with the venue menu selection demands of her fiancé and of her future in-laws. And Nola, don't call her an influencer. She's a content creator who uses her platform to cheerlead for her socialist candidate of choice and shill for sponsors. The candidates on the trail are archetypes: the old white guy, the small town mayor, the action star, the AOC Green New Big Deal, and the Hillary. The weave of storylines includes diverse perspective threads, blending media, politics, ambitions, sanctimony, and individual values within a high-profile parasitic relationship where we're never quite sure which participant is the parasite. The bus and the girls journey their chaotic way through challenges, obstacles, scandal, tragedy, conflicts of interest, and self-discovery. Hop aboard. It is an interesting ride. Very well written, very funny. The Girls on the Bus stars Melissa Benoist, Carla Gugino, Christina Elmore, and Natasha Bayman, and you will find it on HBO.
Would a man freeze his eggs for his career? No, I don't think so.
Hmm.
So I would watch this for that.
Okay.
I'm going to talk about Rachel Maddow's latest book, Prequel, An American Fight Against Fascism. This is an expanded work based on her podcast called Ultra. It's about fascist sympathizers in the U.S. in the 1930s. This fight we're in right now to protect democracy from autocratic and fascist tendencies goes back to before World War II. It's all the rumblings we're experiencing right now, only worse. Anti-Semitism, white Christian nationalism, foreign influence on elections, a well-formed disinformation campaign, constant assaults on our democratic institutions, paramilitary units that stored bombs and ammunition to ultimately take over the government. There was a number of congressmen, senators, and other elected officials involved. Like 25 people in Congress were involved in these plots. It's hard to get your head around how popular these movements were back then. There was the Christian Front, the American White Guard, the Silver Legion of America. The biggest was the German-American Bund that fantasized about a fascistic country under the rule of a Hitler-like character. Bund meetings were so popular, they filled Madison Square Garden for meetings several times over. You'll be gobsmacked that this was our country before and during World War II. At the time, there were 5 million members of the KKK. There were Nazi youth summer camps all over Long Island. A radio priest, Father Coughlin, had 30 million listeners a week. He was a staunch anti-Semite, supporting a fascist government, and had armed soldiers ready to do battle with the government. But thankfully, there was a handful of patriotic activists and journalists who were able to uncover these plots, engage the Department of Justice, and get many of the plotters indicted and tried. If you're somebody like me, who sits at home fretting over whether we're going to survive this dark turmoil that we're in right now, you need to read this book, because you'll learn that we've been here before. And even though we've been farther down the rabbit hole, somehow we're able to survive. So it's a really well-written piece of work from her.
She is doing such important work.
All right, let's bring Kevin Pollak in here.
Oh, yay.
Before it's time to feed his cats. For my money, one of the great impressionists, one of the few comedians able to successfully transition from stand-up to a wonderful movie and TV career. He was in The Usual Suspects, which I think is one of the most interesting plots ever put in a movie, A Few Good Men, Willow, American Crime Story, and The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. If you're a fan of the five spectacular seasons of Mrs. Maisel, you're going to love Kevin's new podcast, Mrs. Maisel Rewatch. Fans get to listen to Kevin have conversations with co-stars and others involved in the show as they reflect back on particular episodes they liked. He gets really granular, too. It's getting into the process, the shooting, the acting, the production. It's fun for anybody interested in the business. Welcome, Kevin Pollak.
Why, hello there.
All right, Kevin. Thank
you for plugging ye old podcast.
You're great. You're a great conversationalist. They're very interesting.
Its proper title, of course, My Mrs. Maisel Pod. That's the annoying title.
And that is how you will
search
Google it.
Okay. My Mrs. Maisel Pod.
Okay. And you've done like 40 episodes now, right? Something like that.
Yeah, I was just post-producing episode 47. So yeah, we're into it. I think only 40-something have dropped.
So Dana Bash is the one I was listening to most recently, but I think you cut her into two parts, correct?
There are two parts for Dana Bash. Yeah.
All right. So before we get into all that stuff,
please.
So William Shatner returned to Earth after his brief space trip on the Amazon delivery truck with a nose cone, and he was standing outside his capsule, and he gave this beautiful speech, these very articulate emotional comments. And while he was doing it, all I could think about was you doing the speech later as William Shatner.
Sorry about that.
No. Unbelievable. But you know, Shatner is just one of the spectacular impressions you do. So this is an interesting podcast, Kev. I like the rewatch format. Are other shows doing that yet?
Oh gosh, yes.
Oh, are they?
Check your Google.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a bunch of rewatch. Yes.
Okay.
I was too early to the podcast world with Kevin Pollak's chat show, where I did ended up doing 10 years, 400 episodes, very long form. No censorship. So I would get a couple of hours starting in 2009. I got a hour and a half 2009 interview with Elon Musk.
Wow.
That's pre Bond villain, Elon Musk.
Wow.
Yeah.
And did you had no foreshadowing, no sense of the future with him that he was going to be a fascistic dictator or anything like that?
Well, you'll have to dial in and watch the episode.
Oh, okay.
See if you can tell. There was no certain, well, yeah, I mean, just the Roadster was on the street. The Model S wasn't even out yet, let alone the others that followed. Wow. It was very, very early in his Tesla success.
Oh.
The 2009 version was quite a bit different in every possible way. Sure.
Well, the guy's a genius. I mean, he's privatized the space industry. There's no question about it. He's just a little Aspergery and a little crazy. I love listening to your Jason Alexander one because you're two great performers, and you guys reflected on one of the episodes from season 4. And it was really interesting to me to hear him talk about his insecurities of coming onto your set, thrown into a pre-established families of actors that you were, and then feeling like a novice until he could get his legs underneath him. That was touching. It was touching to hear somebody with his skills feeling uncomfortable for a minute.
Yeah, well, he's a very open book. So it is a great conversation in three parts. He will share those kind of experiences, and many people have who've come on the pod, but you know, it's like you said, it's potentially entertaining, but certainly instructional, educational listening for anyone interested in a career in front of a camera. And hearing Jason Alexander, of all people, talk about the odd feeling of joining someone else's circus. It's a longstanding tradition. My favorite, Brian Dole Murray, was a longtime neighbor, and I told him I was reoccurring on a television show, and he said, "Oh yeah, I love reoccurring. They're always happy to see you."
That is,
well, you guys talked about acting stuff, and it was so fascinating to listen you talk about the blocking and the one-er doing a long scene with one camera and all that. It's, I mean, even people who are not as familiar with the show, with the five seasons, but who are interested in the mechanics of acting on television, it's really instructive, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. And a lot of conversations I think are going to be quite useful to students of maybe in front of or behind, because I ended up talking to two-parter with David Mullen, who was the multiple Emmy Award-winning cinematographer of the show, but also our multi-Emmy Award-winning wardrobe genius, casting and the production design, all these people who won so many awards over the years for the show, behind the camera. So those are sort of fascinating, in my opinion, as well, yeah.
Well, you can boast a 4.9 review average on Apple, and I think that the missing 0.1 may be due to an E. Herman in Novi, Michigan, who wrote, "Kevin is really good at interviewing the cast and crew of Mrs. Maisel. I look forward to a new episode every week, !! Keep it going, !! And then he gives you a 1-star. So E. Herman, if you are listening, please amend so that your star rating matches your kind and enthusiastic words.
Yeah, yeah. Last I heard, we were 5.0. So, yeah, it would be great if he does, or if they do feel that way. My goodness gracious. Thank you. Yes, please correct it.
Call your grandson, and he'll help you. He'll walk you through it.
There you go.
So this is a beautiful show, and expensive, I'm guessing. The sets, the period wardrobe, the choreography of singing and dancing. It's like a Broadway production. And I heard you say, I think I heard this right, it takes 3 weeks to do one episode. Is that true?
Well, we often had the luxury of 14 days. Yeah, so 3 shoot weeks. But it was just the money that had been found in the couch cushions of Bezos that morning as an Amazon show. But yeah, we had such success right out of the shoot to break through the noise of over 700 scripted television programs on all the various platforms, let alone become this worldwide sensation and then go on to pick up 22 Emmys in such a short run. In fact, we picked up 20 in the first 3 seasons. It was kind of insane. You know, you just want to do good work and you get those scripts and you can't believe this cast and all these geniuses we've spoken about as the department heads. But then to find an audience worldwide for a very, what on paper, niche story has been quite a shock. And
it's a New York Jewish show.
Yeah, yeah. So
the cadence,
the
writing, everything about it is that way, and it's fun. And that's what makes the jokes crackle, and everything about it, I think, comes from that.
But there's a universality to what it is, and it's also kind of comedy fan fiction. If a woman had appeared on the scene who had been able to cut through the way that she did, we're seeing the cast of characters that would have existed had she been there. And so it feels, I don't know, it just feels therapeutic for any woman who has strived to be something somewhere. And I want to comment on the set design, because the detail is so accurate. In your shop, where you work in the shmata industry, shmata is clothing, for those of you that don't speak Yiddish, which I would assume is most of you. But my dad was a furrier in Buffalo, and don't judge, it was an age before polar fleece and rich people were very cold. But the women But the women in the shop were, in my dad's shop, were Italian and Polish immigrants sitting at the lines of sewing machines, and they would wear a brightly patterned pink smock on top of a different brightly patterned print dress. And it, you had never seen that vivid array of patterns, you know, ever before or since. And then watching it in your show, it was like, I hadn't thought about that in 30 years.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And so the way, I don't know how your set designers got enough photographs or enough research and were able to fill each frame with so much accuracy, and that's just so deeply evocative. Can you speak to that, what it felt like to walk on the set every day?
Yes, the attention to detail was more involved and mesmerizing and intimidating all on a daily basis. Yeah. And but you felt like you were in the hands of truly one-of-a-kind creative people who, as you mentioned, had the budget to fulfill those creative whims. There's a great many, you spoke of the word wonder. So that's a shot that doesn't cut from beginning to end of scene. There's no coverage. There's no close-ups. It's all one. And often this would happen 8 to 10 pages, which is a very long time for no cut, which means it was choreographed and rehearsed like a play. And Amy Sherman Palladino, the creator of the show, really our ringleader of this particular circus, she found a love and then devotion to the wonder. So throughout the seasons and series, they continue to evolve to the point where, as a viewer, you may not even be aware that there's been no cut for the last 7 minutes. And it's a very unusual aspect of the show.
Hard on the actors, I'm guessing.
Well, for the other actors who have a ton of theater experience, not as hard at all. To this stand-up comedian with no formal training as an actor, just a fairly impressive body of work, but no training. it was very intimidating and something I had to learn very, very quickly. None of us, as I talk a lot on the podcast, and terms of everyone chiming in and agreeing, none of us just wanted to make sure we weren't the one who spoiled the take, right? Yeah. So you've got 14 moving parts in this 8-minute scene, and you just don't want to be the reason, back to ones, you know. We would take turns doing it, of course, but ultimately no one wanted to be the reason.
An exhausted Steadicam operator, I'm sure.
Jim McConkey, who's, remind me of someone's comment about Ginger Rogers doing everything Fred Astaire did, but backwards and in heels. I don't remember Jim being in heels often, but he really was one of the most impressive Steadicam operators I've worked with.
So paint the picture. He's wearing it around his shoulders and waist and walking backwards, or is there a track?
And no, there's no track. There's him. There's a person behind him as a sort of helping guide. But we, again, when we rehearse, he is doing everything we're doing, but he's going backwards, yes. And swiveling side to side, sometimes letting us pass him, and then he trails us. There's so many pieces to these wonders. And David Mullen, the cinematographer, at the head, forefront of these choreographed.
You talked about Amy. Tell us about the Palladinos and their success before Maisel.
Well, I guess their big hit prior was the Gilmore Girls. They've done other wildly impressive work, but that was a long-running successful show that ultimately had a reprieve on Netflix for a few episodes. But yeah, they're together a singular voice, and they would take turns directing. We had a few guest directors. Scott Ellis, from massive Broadway success, would do an episode every year, and but the two of them really were the showrunners at all times, and the TV's a writer's medium. And so even though they were directing, it was really their creative and brilliant writing and also writing at a pace of dialogue that no one is accustomed to until you get into their universe. You're talking faster than humanly I don't want to say possible, but suggested.
Advised.
It's all ill-advised.
Yeah.
And Rachel Brosnahan, the lead, the very titular character of Mrs. Maisel, on our 80-page scripts often, she would be talking faster than humanly suggested on 74 of them. And so she really did have the bulk of the ridiculous workload.
And often in heels.
98.7% of the time.
Yeah. There was a rumor when the show first caught fire that this was loosely based on Joan Rivers. Is that true or no?
It was not based on Joan. There were elements of Joan's life. There are elements of other performers' lives also. Amy Sherman grew up with a stand-up comedian father, Don Sherman, from the 50s and 60s. And into the decades thereafter. And so she knew that world and wanted to create a fictitious woman to be our central character, to, you know, deal with family issues, deal with a woman trying to make it on her own terms, first thrust into it by a sudden divorce, a husband walking out. But then really taking on this career that wasn't a viable option for women in 1958, I think, when the story starts. And there were a few, but this show does not follow any of their stories. It's fictionalized, some of which based on actual living people. And there's a Lenny Bruce character, of course, Luke Kirby, the brilliant actor, two-time Emmy winner himself. For my money, the best Lenny Bruce interpretation that has ever been.
Wow. Yeah.
Not even close.
He's brilliant, yeah.
You answered one of my other questions with Amy having a father who was a stand-up, so she knew the rhythm, she knew from whence the material came. And up until Mrs. Maisel and up until Hacks, I had never really liked shows about stand-up. I thought they were too transparent, and I was too critical of them because they just weren't convincing to me. But your show, not only the stage stuff, but getting ready for it and being thrust into that world, having no experience, and Hacks, which is hysterical, the writing on that is funny. I'm now a fan of those shows. If they treat it well, I respect them.
Yeah, yes, it's something that stand-up comedian friends of mine, I was very interested in hearing what they all thought, and for the most part, everyone, begrudgingly or otherwise, agreed that, you know, the show hits on so many of the real life decisions, among other things, aspects regarding a stand-up comedian's life.
Were you the only actor, regular actor, who actually is a comedian?
The only series regular, yes. In fact, our lead, again, Rachel Brosnahan, not only had not done much or any comedy, is not a terribly funny person, and she'd be the first to tell you that. And she was certainly the first to tell us. And it speaks to her brilliance as a dramatic actress, because there is so much drama on the show, but her ability to learn comedic rhythms, they are rather musical and lyrical, during those monologues. By working very closely with Amy Sherman and Dan on the pace and you know, how not to play the funny, how not to play the punchlines, how not to play the joke, how to play the reality of someone having to deliver on stage. And many times her monologues were seemingly or by design stream of conscious for the character. She had to learn how to write and tell jokes.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and I give her credit. And I go into Starbucks every week before I come to the show and get a load of Starbucks. That's the only function I really serve here that people appreciate, is that I stop at Starbucks before and I bring them up. But when I go in there, the manager of the Starbucks, his name is Luther. If you're listening, Luther, shout out. He always wants to know who's on the show. And I said, well, this week we have Kevin Pollak from Mrs. Maisel. And he goes, God, I just love Rachel Brosnahan. She's going to be Lois Lane in the new Superman movie. I said, you're telling me something I didn't know. Did you know that?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh. We was celebrated among the cast. We have a family text thread that we are celebrating each other constantly. And we haven't, you know, we finished shooting over about a year and a half ago. And just yesterday with the eclipse, we were all full of jokes and shared experiences. By the way, my favorite thing about the eclipse was watching the larger news organizations, the 24-hour models, and how they would have a field reporter in each step along the path of the eclipse. And every time they would go to a new city, the field reporter would invariably get to the magic moment of the totality and say, I'm without words. I'm sorry. I'm pretty sure this is the poster moment for you have one job.
Words. Words are your job.
Yeah. In 7 of the 8 cities, they all had foreign correspondents and it was cloudy and they couldn't see anything, which was odd. All right. So you had several great moments. As you said, Jason seems to be like an open book with his emotions and everything. But you had an interesting talk about the revelation you often have when you work with somebody on the show who may not have shown that side of their skills. And you mentioned Jane Lynch in particular, somebody who you didn't think was that good or couldn't do those chops. Or I just enjoyed that. Like, even you skilled show business people. Oh, there's an eclipse right there.
Well done, Andy.
When the cattail passes between the camera and the guest.
Yeah, I'm without words, Andy. So the comment on Jane, let's get back to Luther and the shout out for a moment.
Yeah,
my least favorite moment of the retelling of that magical moment was when you mentioned to Luther who was on the show, and he was just excited about Rachel Brosnahan, as opposed to me.
No. I didn't say your name right away because I didn't want to, crack your privacy. And then I told him. And I said that you're a close friend of mine, and you and I have a financial and an emotional relationship. And then
that's right.
Oh,
goodness.
That's right.
Do say more.
So the comment on Jane Lynch was not that I didn't know she could do it. It's that the show did allow certain performers, in her case, the character she played, Sophie Lennon, was, you know, I feel like it's not just a personal inner thought that we actors are as good as our the material we're allowed to do. We're as good as our opportunities. We're, you know, there's been moments that I've been allowed to shine in ways, and Maisel was one of them, that people might not have known, quote unquote, I was capable of. And the reason is because I just hadn't been given those opportunities. And that's how I felt about Jane in the character of Sophie Lennon. Again, she also won an Emmy for that. Is that it was really a depth of a dramatic character that I personally had not seen Jane do. And she became one of my absolute favorite actors on the show.
Yeah, she's playing someone, and there's an ilk of comic who is always on stage in persona, or, you know, in, you know, like Pee Wee Herman, for example. And you guys must know some of these people, and I'm wondering if that was true, the portrayal of someone who has to be somebody else to the public, if their actual personality becomes hard and caustic because of that effort.
Yes, I mean, it's careful what you wish for people who do, as you might say, hide behind a character on stage.
Mm-hmm.
I've known several over the years, and it becomes a point during the height of the success of that onstage persona that the offstage person has a oh no moment.
Yeah, I'm stuck.
You guys You guys ran headlong into COVID, and you and Jason were talking about having to do table reads over Zoom, which must be just awful.
Well, the awful part about COVID, of course, is that so many people's families and lives were put in harm's way, and many deaths, millions. And so it is difficult for me to ever complain about anything to do with show business. I'm not even sure it's a job. So the difficult nature was shutting down for almost a year, that in the middle of this incredibly fun and exciting and successful run. That was just frustrating. But yeah, we found a way back, and people worked. We had our own COVID czar who built a larger, got us into a much larger soundstage and built an airflow system that replicated the outdoors. And if you remember, there came a point about a year into the COVID situation where it was the common belief that you were pretty damn safe outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
that helped us get back to work.
So on your show, or maybe on every rewatch show, this is the routine where not just the guest, but you rewatch an episode. And so I would imagine you're learning a lot or able to receive it differently with some time having passed.
Oh, yeah.
Knowing that you're going to be discussing it on a granular level. So tell us about some of the discoveries.
Well, like any movie you haven't seen in years and you watch it again and you notice things, right? It's similar to that. So especially when you're the one doing it, many of us don't watch things that we're in. So for a lot of the guests, forcing them to watch themselves was interesting. I actually go the other way. Everything I've ever done plays on a continuous loop in my house on 7 different screens. I can't get enough. Sometimes people will come over and I'll ask them to get out of the way. It is, you do find hidden gems within that fast talking that you missed on the page in the table read. And often they would shoot scenes I just wasn't in. My character was sort of comic relief within a comedy. Caroline Aaron plays Shirley Maisel. Shirley and Moish were, I commented that many times, were the comic relief within a comedy. So out of that glorious 14-day shooting schedule, we would work 2 or 3 days tops. That was another reason it was the greatest job ever, because you get a little lazy as you get older.
All right, I want to go back to your origin story and the Petri dish, which was stand-up comedy in San Francisco earlier in your career. I mean, when you look at the team that came out of there, Dana Carvey, Robin Williams, Bobby Slayton, Paula Poundstone, yourself, others, this was like the UConn championship team of stand-up. And I told you this one night at dinner. You guys would all come down here and enter the Los Angeles comedy competitions, blow the roof off the dump, get in your car, and go back up to the Bay Area. And I just always, not jealousy, but I envied the fact that you were able to hone your craft so beautifully in such a supportive community of the arts that San Francisco is. Talk about those early days.
Yeah. Also, Ellen DeGeneres. I mean, the list is kind of endless. Who came through there? Bobcat Goldthwait, and so many people had even started elsewhere, but once they got to San Francisco, they stopped and really honed their craft. And my better half, Jamie and I, we were watching the first part of 2 parts of the Steve Martin documentary last night.
It's so good.
And there was a moment in his 10-plus-year struggle where he finally played the boarding house in San Francisco, where he ultimately recorded his first album, Let's Get Small. But when he did a week run there, it was the first time, he comments in the documentary, where he felt, I found my people.
Mm.
It was true of a great many acts, Lenny Bruce, Jonathan Winters, Woody Allen, through the 60s and 70s. There is something in the water. There is something about the love, almost coddling, of the arts, and stand-up is one of them. There's been a San Francisco Comedy Celebration Day in Golden Gate Park that's been going on at least 40 years, where maybe 35,000 people would come to this free concert, and 75, 80 comedians would go up one after another, 5 minutes each, and this giant free show. Imagine 40 years of that. So, yeah, there is this community up there that's been there and loving and embracing all forms of stand-up. Even Harry Anderson did did, you know, work the streets first of San Francisco before he got on the stage.
Bobby Slayton, I was commiserating with him about the L.A. comedy competitions where they do one night at the Improv and then one night at the Ice House and all these places. And it would take a week. And he would say, you know, when I would come down here to do those competitions, it would cost me money. Because in San Francisco, I could make a living doing stand-up. He was making like $2,000, $3,000 a week doing stand-up. Down here, you make $25 a night, and you had to go on strike to make $25 a night here in L.A. It's so different. It's so different.
Yeah, there are showcase rooms, really, in L.A., whereas in San Francisco, you've got a classic lineup of three performers with an MC, a middle act, and a headliner. And the headliner can make a handsome, you know, career and salary. Where showcase rooms in Los Angeles are giving you, which is ultimately why I moved here in my mid-20s from San Francisco, was to pursue performing in front of people who could put me in TV and movies. And that also is not going to happen in San Francisco.
But you can get good faster because you can make a living just doing stand-up. And then you come here and they can get away with not paying you because you're doing it for the hope, in the hope that someone...
This is Comedy College, says Missy Shore. Yes, you know, exactly. We're allowing you to get good.
Yeah,
okay.
But the dream
yeah,
was...
I would,
go ahead, Kevin.
I was just saying, I would, when I moved here, I would still go back to San Francisco constantly to make a living. And then I would, you know, be here. And then eventually work some comedy clubs in the around the country.
Right.
You don't
so the
do,
dream,
oh, go ahead.
I was just going to ask this real quick question. The dream, I think, for most comics from your generation was do Johnny Carson and then get a sitcom. And you were the guy that went right into movies. Was that natural or was that an accident or was it intentional? How did that transpire for you?
I was in L.A. struggling a couple of years, trying to get an agent, trying to get an audition for anything. And my brother, still up in the San Francisco Bay Area, called me one day and said, you know, I was thinking about it, your struggle down there. You know what you got to do? You got to do that Johnny Carson show.
Wow.
Like it was the first time
really
you ever heard that.
Wisdom.
Thank you, Galileo, with your insight and profound discovery. So yeah, I went on hundreds and hundreds of auditions when I eventually did get an agent where it felt like they were saying, how about anyone but you is going to get this part? And really, you know, in those early days, you were going to take in a celebration, you were going to take any job that came your way, that worked out your way. I remember before I got Avalon, the Barry Levinson, very Jewy saga, which sort of put me on the map as a dramatic actor within the film industry. But 6 months before I got it, I auditioned for Full House, the part that Dave Coulier got, because every comedian of the time auditioned for that part.
Okay.
And would have killed for that opportunity.
Sure.
But then 6 months later, I'm in this dramatic saga for Barry Levinson and suddenly doing movies. And, you know, you can make all the plans you want. But yeah, the difficult part is after A Few Good Men, I went from auditioning to getting offers. And that's a very bizarre turn especially for me, the stand-up comedian first and foremost, because as a comedian, when you're offered stage time, the answer is yes. What time? Where do I go? So as an actor, suddenly getting offers, it was yes. What time? Where do I go? And then the agent was like, maybe we should read the script first and then decide if this is something you should be doing.
You know? Well, you worked with Barry Levinson, who was a great comedy writer, worked with Mel Brooks and all those people. Is it more comfortable for you to work with somebody who you know has a good comedic sense and you trust your work with them?
I think it was more comfortable for him. He loves to have a comedian in his movies. If you look back, he had at least one stand-up in almost every movie he ever directed, especially the ones he wrote and directed. Even when Robin Williams is a central character in Good Morning Vietnam, he's also got Robert Wool, a comedian, in a smaller supporting role.
Yeah.
But so he always loved having a comedian. He started out as a comedian, a comedy team with him and Craig T. Nelson in the coffee houses of the 60s. And so, yeah, I loved being around the set and spritzing with him like two comics. But I was way more fortunate that in this all-important first dramatic role, I was working with a writer-director in Barry Levinson who hated seeing acting. He wanted everything to look and feel spontaneous, which fortunately for me was all I could do. I had no technique. As I mentioned, no training. So I, for some reason, well, not some, but I, having been on stage already as a comedian for so many years and bombed on stage in front of strangers for so long, I got in front of that camera and I just wasn't intimidated. And fortunately he was not controlling me like an intense dramatic director. So yes, the fact that he had a comedic background helped me a great, great deal.
Have you found yourself on a set with someone whose impression you do?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it's not always a good idea to share.
Can you give an example?
I mean, the time it worked out well was Alan Arkin. Ooh. He and Peter Falk were in my favorite comedy film, The In-Laws.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man.
And I had done The Tonight Show. And I knew Johnny loved Peter Falk and had him on all the time. So when I was first asked by the gatekeeper, Jim McCauley, to do stand-up on the show, I just had this instinct that I would do better from the couch doing my impressions. And I knew the protocol. He couldn't bring me to the couch. So I asked if we wait till I had a movie or a TV show that where he could justify bringing me to the couch. And then I would do my impressions and things from the couch, specifically Peter Falk. Because again, I knew Johnny loved him and had mm-hmm. Peter on during the Columbo run several times a year.
Yeah.
Sure enough, there I am behind that famous curtain, and I hear Johnny say, "Now, folks, my next guest is an actor and a young comedian named Kevin Pollak. He's got a new movie out directed by Ron Howard called Willow. Please welcome Kevin Pollak." I came out and I sat next to the king. And, there's a pre-interview to those shows, spoiler alert. Yeah. And in the pre-interview, Jim McCauley, the gatekeeper, producer of the segments for the comedian, said, "What do you want Johnny to ask you to thereby help set up your stories?" And I, well, just have him ask me if I do impersonations, and I'll be top-loaded for what comes next. And sure, so Johnny said, "Now, we'll talk about Willow, Kevin, in just a moment. Somebody told me backstage that you do impersonations. Is that nice?" And without missing a beat, I crossed one eye, as I had taught myself to do, because Peter Falk famously had one glass eye. Mm-hmm. And I just went right into it. "Johnny, that's a bold-faced lie. I don't know who told you that, and I wish they had, quite frankly." And he, as I had predicted, was howling, laughing so hard, and invited me back to be a guest on the show 2-3 times a year until he retired.
Oh.
And I'm convinced it's
that's kind of
a
heroin you can't explain to other people when the boss goes nuts over your set.
Yeah. Boy. Yeah, but then running into Peter Falk at the produce section at Ralph's a week later, and he accosted me by the carrots saying, "How do you do that with your arm?" "Me, I understand, but how do you do that?"
Really?
Oh, yes. So I took that impression to the set of a movie I did called Indian Summer. So when I met Alan Arkin, mm-hmm. who's in the film as well, I went up to him doing Peter Falk to try to win his favor. And he said, "Oh, my God, that's unbelievable. You know Peter? That's crazy. That's not Peter in movies or television. That's him in the kitchen. That's crazy." So then I eventually learned how to do Alan, and I remember he said, "Somebody told me you do me, is that right?" And I said, "I can't do you." And he said, "Wait a second, is that me? That's not funny." But he went on to love it, and we had such a great friendship over the years.
He was a truly skilled actor. In the film, I can't remember the title of it, but where he played the deaf and dumb person. What was the name of that film? Where he played the person who couldn't talk, and he
Lonely are the hunter.
Yes,
maybe?
The Heart of the Lonely Hunter.
Heart of the Lonely Hunter.
Oh my goodness, yeah. It was so spectacular. Yeah. He was one. And then I thought it was a great swan song for him to do the Comiskey method too. He was so funny in that. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. We talked about that and everything else. And there's a big festival in San Francisco called Sketchfest, and they do, you know, stand-up shows and improv shows and sketch shows. And they also do these sort of cast reunions for movies and TV shows. I've moderated a bunch like Spinal Tap and A Mighty Wind.
Oh, my goodness.
And so one year they asked me to moderate, interview Alan Arkin, and they were going to show The In-Laws. And so, you know, something like that for someone, again, you would just impersonate in your act, and then you got to work with, and then you got to know personally, and then you find yourself on stage at the Castro Theater in San Francisco in front of a couple thousand people, talking to him in conversation. And it was just, he was just an extraordinary person on top of the talent.
Well, I want to talk about Usual Suspects, because I think it's really one of the most interesting plots in a film that anybody has ever seen. And you mentioned in one of your discussions, I don't know if it was with Jason or somebody else, that you improvised a lot of your best work in that. Is that true?
Well, the screenplay, which went on to win the Academy Award, is still the best film screenplay I've read. And once we started shooting, the director was comfortable with me also improvising. So consequently, I'd say 70% conservatively, but probably higher, of the dialogue lines people quote to me as fans on the street, goes the saying, or in a restaurant or a men's room at the airport, it is something I improvised in the film. And in fact, Chris McQuarrie, who was the 26-year-old punk who won that Oscar and now is writing and directing the Mission Impossible movies, I still bug him to this day that he should let me have the Oscar 1 week out of the year. He can have 51. He can have 51 weeks, and mm-hmm. then 1 week out of the year, that trophy sits on my mantle. Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, the best script I've ever read.
Wow.
Not to take anything away. But just for example, in the first moments of the film when the suspects are being rounded up individually before the lineup, they see each one of us getting arrested. And my character is working on a car. He's working on the side mirror with a screwdriver, and the garage door behind him opens up and five officers rush in, guns drawn. And I see them in through this side mirror. And in the script, I was just supposed to use the oily rag to wipe off my hands, maybe my brow, and then toss it over that side mirror to transition into the next scene. There was no dialogue written. But in fact, when five police officers rush through this suddenly open garage door, in the moment, I said, "Are you sure you brought enough guys?" And that's in the film. So just one example of...
That's beautiful. So we do a little game called IMDb Roulette, where I say the name of, you have 156, I believe, IMDb credits. I say the name of a show, and then you tell us, like, who you played and what you remember about the experience.
Okay. Another game you might consider,
yeah.
I'm happy to play this one,
sure.
Is 2 degrees of Kevin Pollak. I don't know why Kevin Bacon needs six.
Yeah, that's...
I can get you to anyone in 2 degrees.
I bet you can.
And by degrees,
wow.
it means a handshake away.
So the first, number one, will get you 1 degree to Sherman Helmsley. So we're going to start with Amen.
Amen.
And you played?
What character did I play?
Yeah, and what do you remember about being on the set?
Well, that was so early that, of course, I couldn't possibly remember the name of my character or what they ended up calling me, you know. But I do remember... Ed Weinberger was one of the creators of the show, and he had come from Taxi. And I remember seeing his name in the Taxi credits. So by the time I got this golden opportunity as an actor, I wanted to pick his brain as a writer, and even pitched him an idea for a show, which was behind the scenes of a National Enquirer, which he said his response was, "I think the real National Enquirer stories are too bizarre for fiction, and they're ultimately more interesting than what the fictionalized version of those stories would be. At any rate, that is my memory from working on Amen.
Oh, wow, what a cool memory, though, of getting to talk to him. So for number two, we have L.A. Story.
Back to Steve Martin, yep.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I played Frank, his agent, and when Mary Lou Henner, who plays his girlfriend, has an affair with me, is Steve Martin's character's comment when he finds out is, I thought Frank was only supposed to take 10%.
Yeah. Number three is Wayne's World 2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I play the single ocular albino, that is, he has one white eye, at the city's sort of register to use parks and things. So I don't know that my character, he must have had a name, but I don't remember what it is. I just remember he had a problem with the contract, make sure you cross the T's and dot the lowercase J's.
Okay. For number four, and this was particularly interesting to me because I'm obsessed with this show, Drunk History.
Uh-huh. I played, I think, an artichoke king, maybe?
His name is Ciro Terranova. I'm not sure. But talk a little bit about the process of Drunk History, because you guys are all sort of pantomiming a story that a drunk person has told previously, and are they blasting the audio onto the set so that you know what words to mouth? What's the process?
Yeah, no, they're playing. They are absolutely playing the recording of the individual who allowed themselves to get drunk on camera and tell the story.
Yeah,
so that you can lip sync it. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Fortunately for me, my first act when I was 10 was lip syncing a comedy album. My mother caught me doing it at home alone, and her response was, "That's it, you're doing that for the Zookers at Passover."
What was his album?
My mom booked me on my first gig.
Wow.
Which was the white painted out brick fireplace, like a foot and a half deep and maybe 3 feet wide, that I performed for the gathered family. Well, it was the biggest comedy album at the time. And unfortunately for me and so many others, they did not put in the liner notes, this comedian will go on to be the most prolific serial rapist in history.
Yeah, I know.
Understood.
So Bill Cosby, yeah.
Sure. All right. So number five, our final entry is American Crime Story. It was a Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky scandal.
Impeachment, yeah.
Yeah, impeachment, sorry. And you play?
I played the head counsel for the White House. Historical character in that regard.
His name is Bernie Nussbaum.
Correct. Continue. Small Jews for 400.
All right. I have to talk about A Few Good Men before we... You tell
sure.
The greatest anecdote about Rob Reiner doing line readings to actors, including Jack Nicholson. And line readings to most actors are verboten. It assaults their egos, and they just don't like it. And so the
concept of a line reading for the audience is a director will be frustrated by the timing and pace of an actor's performance. And the line reading is the worst way you can inform that actor, because as the director giving a line reading, you will say, no, not like that, like this. And then the director will act out the moment for you. So you can imagine why that might not be enjoyable. You're usually hired because they liked the way you did it. So in the case of Rob Reiner and A Few Good Men, we had the luxury of rehearsal for a couple of weeks. And so on an empty soundstage, much like I'm told when you rehearse a play, having not done them, I never understood when I was offered to do a play why I would want to share the stage with other people. but there was tape on the ground of this soundstage, you know, simulating the courtroom or whatever scene we were doing. And first, Rob was directing rehearsal for Tom Cruise, Demi Moore, and myself for a number of days. And during that time, it became apparent that he was giving what I would call involuntary line reading. So because Rob is an actor first, he after we would rehearse a scene, he would say, you know, that was great. Great job, you guys. And very enthusiastic. And he would say invariably, Kevin, you know that point where you get to the thing and you say, so instead of saying the line, he would start to act it out. But you could instantly tell that Rob didn't mean it as an insulting line reading. He was getting caught up in the actual moment in the scene, and he would end up acting out all the parts for the next 3 or 4 minutes of the scene, because he just loves, you know, being involved in that way. However, you do have to make peace with, okay, this is the way he communicates. He will share his enthusiasm for the scene and the moment and the thing, not as a way to correct your performance, but let you know what's inside of his head, the musical rhythm of dialogue. So when Jack finally joined us for rehearsal, and Jack was a lot more of a goofball than I anticipated. He was, you know, I expected someone that successful and that cool. He was cool to already five generations by the time I worked with him. I'm not even sure how the math works, but he was so cool. I thought someone like that would be aloof, you know. You'd have to talk about him, not to him. But he was the most approachable and gregarious mega star I've ever met. So a real sweet, sweet man and goofball and funny and all of that. So the very first time we're in rehearsal and he is, in fact, rehearsing the what would become famous soliloquy with the line, "You can't handle the truth" in it. He finishes doing it. And I will say, for a first time rehearsal, he's 93% there. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. He's not finding it. He's there. But when he finishes, Rob is enthusiastic with his enjoyment of it. He's so grateful that Jack's already there and you've got it. You've nailed it. I'm so happy. I knew you'd be so amazing in this. But as Rob is offering up the compliment, the first part of the compliment sandwich, if you had an overhead camera looking down on the Tom DeMee and I and those two, five of us, you would probably see Tom DeMee and I in a line. And as Rob is doing the first part of the compliment sandwich, you would overhead camera see the three of us take two steps back.
Because here
in anticipation
comes, baby,
of what was coming. And so Rob invariably got to the point of the compliments where he said, really, it's just that one little piece where, you know, where you say, and then Rob starts doing the dialogue. He's not doing an impression of Jack. He's not even performing like the way you should do it. He's just the way you would tell a story. Remember when the guy said, don't touch the pickles until you get, you know, he's not. Anyways, Tom DeMee and I take a few steps back. Yep. Rob finishes giving his non-line reading. And we're waiting. And finally, Jack, who's been seated this entire time and still is, says to Rob, yes, well, I guess I'm not there yet.
Oh, man.
Which I thought was a pretty effective way to communicate back to your director, we won't be doing this again.
No.
Yeah.
Whoa. So what? That was it? That's the take that's in the film?
Well, so that was during rehearsal. But
oh, okay.
When we were filming, he really was letter perfect every take. It was just astonishing.
So Jack and Cruz and DeMee, wow. I mean, was there an
intimidation? No, where's Waldo in that cast? You've got Kevin Bacon, Kiefer Sutherland.
Is there an intimidation factor when you have to work under those circumstances?
Beyond belief. And, you know, again, if I hadn't been treated like an equal instantly by all of these massive stars, I don't know what it would have felt like and what I might have gone through. But to their credit, which I will never stop giving and celebrating and appreciating, they all from moment one, did not treat me like the new guy, which I was, as much as they did treat me like they treated each other, which was, I'm not even sure it was necessary.
Well, you said in your conversation with Jason Alexander that you get that role because Jason is going to be doing a second season of Seinfeld.
Yes, this is another legend in lore, which I have shared happily. Yeah, I was doing another a 6-week summer series created by Rob Reiner and Christopher Guest called Morton and Hayes, about a comedy team in the 30s. This was in 91 or 90, and yeah, there was no original programming on during the summer. And so they would throw up these summer series that really were shows that the network had no interest in. They just paid for them, so they threw them up. But while we were shooting it, I was having lunch every day with Rob. And one day at lunch, he said, you know, I'm just thinking, my next project is this movie I'm doing. It's a very successful Broadway play called A Few Good Men. And I've got Tom Cruise for the lead, which is amazing. I think I'm going to get Jack Nicholson. But there's this part of Tom's co-counsel that I've got an offer out to Jason Alexander. But if Seinfeld gets picked up for season two, he won't be available. And I'm thinking now that you would, in fact, be perfect for this. Now, a little context. Seinfeld at that point had only aired the first 4 episodes. They were called the Seinfeld Chronicles. They were on Friday night, mm-hmm. and 11 people watched them.
Yeah.
And it was a big, this is not going forward, was the understanding. And it was only NBC's infatuation with Jerry as a stand-up that they ultimately decided to try a second season. But after Rob said that to me, it was believed at the time that there was no way that show was going to go. But Rob's company, Castle Rock, was the producing entity of Seinfeld. You'll see it at the end of the credits of the show every time, The Lighthouse. And so he was hoping that the series would get picked up. So he was making backup plans, which is why he mentioned it to me. Mm-hmm. I, of course, went home and prayed for another person's success like you cannot believe. In Jason's, and it worked out rather well for both of them.
Yeah, it sure did.
I bet it's fun to do a piece like A Few Good Men that's been honed on stage for many years. The writing is impeccable. There's no air in it. It just is perfect. The writing is perfect, and it must make your job easier.
Yes, and Aaron Sorkin, it was his first play, and it was his first screenplay, and he was very young. So he was not the Aaron Sorkin we know today by any stretch, quite the opposite. He was a puppy on stage while we were shooting on a sound stage, not a Broadway stage.
A pivotal moment for all concerned. And we want to just thank you so much, Kevin, for joining us. What a delightful conversation. I'm going to read our closing credits. But before I do so, would you want to mention anything about where folks can find the podcast?
Well, your audience knows if they're listening to yours, that however you get your podcast goes the saying, my Mrs. Maisel Pod. And we're just finding our way, and it'd be great to have anyone from your audience who's interested in any of the aspects that we discussed earlier to give us a listen and rate and review and all that stuff.
You're skilled in so many ways, Kevin, as a stand-up, as an actor, as a host on that show. You're so comfortable to listen to. Continued success. It was really special having you on today.
And thanks for coming.
Both.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for coming along. We would love to continue this conversation with you on Instagram and Twitter, where we are at MediaPathPod, and on Facebook, where our show page is MediaPath Podcast, and our Facebook group is MediaPath with Fritz and Wheezy Podcast Community. You can find full video podcast episodes loaded with bonus visual content on our YouTube channel at MediaPath Podcast. We would love it if you would judge our appearance and then subscribe. You can write to us at MediaPathPodcast@gmail.com. We want to know what you've been watching, listening to, enjoying. If you enjoy this show, please give us a nice rating wherever you get your podcasts and share our social media posts so that your friends can learn about your excellent taste in podcasts. Our website is MediaPathPodcast.com. It is a great place to browse around and find interesting episodes you may have missed. We also have a fun and sassy newsletter loaded with bonus photos and quizzes and more dish about our guests. All the newsletters are right there for you to enjoy on our website, or you can sign up to get your newsletter sent directly into your inbox, and we'll just send you one per week. We do understand healthy boundaries. We want to thank our wonderful guest, Kevin Pollak. Our team includes producer Dina Friedman, John Maddox, Bill Filipiak, Mason Brown, Garrett Arch, Jordan Reyes, and you. Our theme music is by me and John Maddox. I am Louise Planker, here with Fritz Coleman and Kevin Pollak. Be well and wise, and we will see you along the media path.
Excellent, Kevin. Thank you so much.
Hold your pose for 30 more seconds.